dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It is my distinct privilege and high pleasure to be able to have for a full hour of conversation one of our regulars at Secure Freedom Radio, Diana West. But not just to do what she does brilliantly, which is assess the culture and the developments of the day against the backdrop of our national security interests and the like, but to address in detail the substance and content of her brand new book from, I'm very pleased to say, the Center for Security Policy Press. It is entitled The Red Thread, and it is a search for ideological drivers inside the anti-Trump conspiracy. Those of you who are listeners to our program know her very well. She is the author of two other terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings and publishings elsewhere at dianawest.net. Diana, thank you so much for, first of all, joining us, and second of all, for this terrific new contribution to our understanding of what on earth has been going on in this so-called Trump collusion with Russia scandal.
Yes, thank you, Frank. I'm very much looking forward to speaking about this and trying to illuminate those things.
It requires illumination, needless to say. But let's just, since we have the luxury of dealing with this in detail, let's just spend the first few minutes talking about sort of the context, if we can. You have a marvelous quote in the book from Whitaker Chambers, and maybe we could just recite that as a starting point for what we'll be discussing.
Yes, it really is a driver of this work, of all the work I do, and American Betrayal as well. And it actually gets to the heart of the assault on our nation, on our Constitution, on our culture. And this is it. It's from Witness, and the quote is, "That power to influence policy has always been the ultimate purpose of the Communist Party's infiltration. It was much more dangerous and, as events have proved, much more difficult to detect than espionage, which beside it is trivial, though the two go hand in hand."
So just to recalibrate, Whitaker Chambers, of course, was a notorious communist agent who flipped and became basically the prism through which much of what we came to know about the communist infiltration of the United States during the 30s and 40s, right up, I guess, until his death in his famous book, Witness, and his testimony before Congress. He really laid bare what was the agenda, as well as a lot of the operational detail of the communists. And this is important because what your thesis is in this book is that's a wellspring of this effort to take down Donald Trump as well. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And the key and another feature that people should recall about Whitaker Chambers too is that he was the instrument through which the court case against Alger Hiss, the notorious State Department spy for Stalin, actually went to prison on perjury related to espionage. So this is a very important figure in this tragic and outrageous history that we still are trying to get our arms around. The point of this particular epigraph that's so important, though, here, because this is something we've lost, is this notion of communist influence. People tend to review the Cold War and this history as a series of espionage exercises of stealing secrets and plans and formulas, the most notorious being the Rosenberg ring that stole atomic secrets. However, influence influence is what Whitaker Chambers is saying was the key prize of Soviet intelligence and their assault on America, inserting, embedding covert operatives and ideological communists, fellow travelers, and the rest inside the federal government, cultural institutions, educational institutions, etc. We're focusing on the federal government here. And this becomes really a lost history that is essentially what American Betrayal is about. And what I'm trying to do here in terms of reviving the study of influence, of Marxist influence, and how it works in the red thread. So I'm trying to kind of add some continuity here to our history that I think has been broken and lost to us. And that's why we've had such a hard time really understanding these events, even as we've been trying to even get them down on paper and understand what happened. But in terms of interpreting this conspiracy, this coup, there's a lot more to it than the mechanics.
Mm-hmm. I want to get to all of that, of course, the background, the history, the personal predilections of the various players in this drama of the investigation of Donald Trump and the effort to take down first his candidacy and then his presidency. But just touching on the mechanics of the coup, so we at least take note of this, you have mentioned a series of, well, I guess gates is now what we call these things in the aftermath of Watergate. Just touch very quickly, Dinah, we don't have time to get into them in detail and won't, but just tick off the names you've given to the various phases of this effort to take down Donald Trump.
Yes. Well, this is the mechanics that we've actually been able to put together at this point. We start with Dossiergate, where we see the dossier created by the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign through Fusion GPS. We've seen the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private server, which I call Servergate. Then we see the rigged secret court system that allowed the federal agencies to engage in spying, domestic espionage against the GOP presidential campaign, which we can call FISAGate, Spygate. We go on to what we're living through today with this special counsel endeavor to investigate the Trump presidency and bring it down, which I considered Muellergate. So we're looking at a series of operations that are very difficult to understand. They're very opaque. And most of our energies and most of the investigative resources have been expended to really unravel these covert happenings inside the federal government and around the federal government. So this would be what I would call the mechanics of the conspiracy, the mechanics of the coup.
Well, I wish that it were the case that much effort has been expended to unravel these. I think it's fair to say that some has, certainly by your good self and our friends at Judicial Watch and some on the congressional panels, but most of it, really, let's be honest, has been focused on chasing this will-o'-the-wisp of Donald Trump's collusion, alleged collusion, and yes, covering up what has been going on inside the government. Dinah, with this very helpful sort of scene setting, let's turn to some of the backgrounds and extraordinary agendas, it seems, of the dramatis personae of these various scandals. We'll do that with Dinah West right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back for the second installment of what really is kind of a sneak preview of Dinah West's brand new book by the Center for Security Policy Press. It will be out, I think, officially on Friday, though you can order it today at Amazon. It is entitled The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. And Dinah, we have set the scene for a conversation about the individuals that you have identified who have some very problematic, I think it's fair to say, backgrounds and leanings and, it would seem, proclivities. Let's start with this woman by the name of Nellie Orr. Who is she? Who is she married to? And what have you learned about her?
That is a great place to start, because I would say this is where the thread begins for me. Watching the news unfold, this would be back in December 2017, when Fox News' James Rosen broke a story to the effect that there was this couple, Nellie and Bruce Orr, at the heart of the Steele dossier gate, at the heart of the Fusion GPS efforts in this whole morass, who both were inside, Nellie Orr being inside Fusion GPS as the Russia expert, with Bruce Orr, her husband, being a very senior official at the Justice Department. This was shocking. And the thing that becomes fascinating and also traceable about Nellie Orr is that she was an academic. She was a professor at Vassar of Russian affairs, Russian studies. This became a place to look more deeply at who these people are, because when we look at some of these other players, all we really see are the big jobs and the law schools and the resumes that really don't tell us anything about how they think, what they believe. However, with an academic, it turns out that there would be papers, book reviews, theses, things like that, where you could actually start to unravel the thinking behind the behavior. So Nellie Orr became my subject actually for a couple of months. And the first thing I produced ran at the American Spectator, looking at Nellie Orr's academic work and her ideological bias, which, frankly, the best way to shorthand it is an apologist for Stalin. This becomes quite clear. I know it's shocking. Since how could this be in 2019?
Who would defend Joseph Stalin?
Well, this is where I come down on that, because you find in her writings, and this would be for, say, a half a dozen book reviews that were very easily available online at HNET, a social sciences site, where she's reviewing books and talking about, quote, the agonizing paradoxes of the Stalinist state. Now, how could there be paradoxes in the Stalinist state unless, indeed, there are things that you find positive as well as negative? And indeed, you see this kind of balance where she's talking about, for example, in this particular instance, one would be building a legal structure, yet torturing and executing innocent citizens. So she's weighing the so-called legal structure. I mean, a Stalinist legal structure is no legal structure at all. However, she's weighing this appearance with the torture and execution of innocent citizens, whereas actually that is part and parcel of the Stalinist legal state, we would say. However, you see her mindset starting to come into shape. So she's talking about opportunities for poor people, but no political representation. So she's weighing this. You start to see this repeated in her work, where she also talks about the frustration as a professor, she's writing at Vassar, to convey, quote, and this is again about the Stalin period, she's talking about, quote, the frustration of conveying the terror and excitement of the Stalin era. So we are looking at someone who's very open to what Stalin was trying to do. That becomes a place where I dig in and start to build out an ideological profile of Nellie Orr, which becomes relatively simple because she does write, you know, and publish, and the people who she is, the professors, the other scholars whom she cites and is also essentially guided by and mentored by, are part of a school in American history known as a revisionist school from the 1970s and 80s, which was all about soft-soaping Stalin and the rest of the Soviet structure, and essentially presenting it as less than totalitarian.
And not just really the Soviet structure and some of its leading lights, but the whole Soviet project, really, the enterprise.
Just to say that, yeah. Nellie Orr becoming a principal author of the dossier designed to bring Donald Trump down for Hillary Clinton, being a person with communist sympathies, with someone, an academic with this point of view, becomes a very key moment in trying to understand the ideological bias of these people, what they're really trying to do.
But it also puts into sharp relief one of the anomalies of this whole claimed collusion conspiracy, and that is there is abundant evidence that Hillary Clinton was the person with whom the Kremlin would much have preferred to do business rather than Donald Trump, and indeed colluded with extensively and had been both in her official capacity and subsequently. Indeed, she was the commissioner, I guess one would say, her campaign of this dossier in the first place. So having somebody with certain, shall we say, Marxist sympathies at the very least as one of the co-authors of it, as you say, in her capacity as a Fusion GPS employee is a pretty extraordinary insight into who we're dealing with here. But connect the dots to her husband, too, if you would, Diana West.
Yes. Well, here we get back more to the mechanics of this conspiracy, because Bruce Orr, as a senior Justice Department official, I believe the most senior career official at the Justice Department, number four, people say, at that time, before he was demoted over this, although he continues to draw his paycheck and work there in other capacity. They were essentially a tag team bringing information into the Justice Department, filtering into the FBI, also dealing with the person I consider to be Nellie Orr's opposite number, because I should add, Nellie Orr also does have a CIA affiliation that has not been explored or really laid out.
Really?
Yes, she does. She in 2010, she is listed on a paper with her husband and Glenn Simpson, her future employer at Fusion GPS, as being a researcher at the CIA's open source shop, essentially. And we don't know the extent of that affiliation. We don't know if she knows John Brennan, if she ever worked with John Brennan. We don't know if she's on staff or a contractor. These are questions that must be answered to really fill it in. But when we think about Christopher Steele, the man whose name is on the dossier, the former MI6 officer, we really see her opposite number here, because what we learn about Christopher Steele, not much, because he spent his career in intelligence, and these people are supposed to be anonymous, but in his early years at Cambridge, where he was president of the debating society there, he was known on campus, and indeed his debating society record verifies some of this that I've been able to find. He was known as a, quote, according to the Daily Mail, confirmed socialist. I mean, this is something that becomes very important when you're looking to build this out in terms of an ideological movement.
And of course, it was Christopher Steele who was supposedly tapping his Russian sources for information of Donald Trump's dealings with Russia or activities in Moscow, for example, that filled out some of the most, shall we say, colorful parts of this dossier. But you're saying, Diana West, if I can try to not put words in your mouth, of course, but just simply capture the thought here, that both Nellie Orr and Christopher Steele are people with ideological backgrounds that fit the profile of not simply apologists for the Soviet Union or Russia or the Kremlin, but people who would be very prone to advance the interests of Kremlin operatives right on up to Putin, presumably.
Yes, and I would, to really underscore that, when Christopher Steele was in his college days at Cambridge, one of the other pieces of information that comes forward from that period from British reporting is that he was not only a confirmed socialist, but he had what they called CND credentials. CND was the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in the 1980s, 1970s, 1980s in Britain, very hard left, a number of Marxists involved.
Yeah. Soviet front.
Yes, advancing Soviet interests in this very important period. This would have moving toward the Reagan 80s, where President Reagan was attempting to rebuild our forces.
Deploy intermediate range missiles there, right?
Yes. Now imagine when candidate Trump announces that he is sent, and this would have been in about April 2016, which is when a lot of this was coalescing, that he is going to be the man to not only rebuild our military, but to revamp our nuclear arsenal. Imagine how this would be, call up the war cry to the old CND activists, the old confirmed socialists, etc., how perhaps this could be even a motivation for this Brit to become so terribly concerned and desperate not to see Donald Trump become president. This we know from Bruce Orr and his communications with the FBI. So you start seeing a real inner game here that is not apparent on the surface. And this is what the Red Thread attempts to bring to light.
Yeah. Dinah, we're going to have to pause. I want to make sure we don't lose this theme of the direct interest that the Russians had in stopping Donald Trump and having people with these kinds of characteristics, whether they're full-fledged operatives or they're simply agents of influence or whether they're fellow travelers or whatever one might call them, we'll explore with you in greater detail straight ahead.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are visiting with Dinah West, the author of a brand new book by the Center for Security Policy Press, The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. Dinah, it's fascinating to hear about some of these characters, Nellie Orr and her husband, Bruce Orr, and Christopher Steele, of course, who have been sort of in the mix. But I want to turn to one of the really big fish in this conspiracy, namely James Comey, the former director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations. What have you uncovered about his own ideological leanings and background?
His red thread. James Comey was a very interesting subject for this particular kind of an investigation because there actually is quite a lot to unroll coming from Comey himself. And again, all of this is open source material that is just, you know, I'm putting together in a new way. James Comey himself frequently invokes the liberal Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, whose name is quite famous to this day. However, most people don't, and I certainly don't really know that much about his writings except for the fact they can call him a liberal Protestant theologian. But when Comey was on Twitter on the QT, his handle was Niebuhr, Reinhold Niebuhr. When the New York Times in 2018, when he was releasing his memoir, A Higher Loyalty, asked him about the most influential books on his life in 2018, he mentioned two Reinhold Niebuhr books coming from the 1930s and I believe 1940, a period when Niebuhr was himself at his most militant and Marxist.
So liberal is not quite an accurate portrayal of his place on the political spectrum?
Absolutely not. And there's a number of discussions of Niebuhr's writings in the Red Thread that make this very clear. It's not a matter of me interpreting. These are very strong statements by Niebuhr himself. But in terms of constructing a red thread, we could actually do a little intellectual history here because when James Comey was a student at William & Mary, and this would be, I believe he graduated class of 82, his main thesis advisor was a man named James C. Livingston. Well, when James C. Livingston was a student himself in the 1950s at Union Theological Seminary in New York, his professor, he also studied under Reinhold Niebuhr, and another professor named Paul Tillich. Well, Paul Tillich came from Nazi Germany as a refugee, having been an associate of the Frankfurt School. So we are really looking at a FBI director, not of the old school, but of the Frankfurt School, when we look at this chain of intellectual custody going from Tillich and Niebuhr to Livingston to Comey. And indeed, in I think one of the most interesting interviews by James Comey I've ever seen, I believe it was 2003 in New York Magazine, which is discussed in the Red Thread, he admitted that while at William & Mary, he was a communist. He himself considered himself to be a communist.
This is the man who went on to become the director of the FBI. I have to believe that J. Edgar Hoover is spinning in his grave at a pretty high RPM Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. And also, don't forget, during the Bush administration, he was the number two, the Rod Rosenstein, shall we say, of the Justice Department under John Ashcroft, which you could hardly imagine a stranger pairing when you come right down to it. And this also is discussed. So you're starting to see, right, a really interesting chain of intellectual custody here that becomes very valid when you start examining his behavior as FBI director, where you start seeing the ends justify the means, which we might sort of distill as the basis of this sort of Marxist grasp for power, being used by Comey every which way, whether it's in dealing with Hillary Clinton's server or his own testimonies or, you know, essentially the way he leaked info. You know, so many of these behaviors we can start to actually see in this same sort of intellectual mindset. And it's very dangerous to our democracy.
Well, one would think, and one would think it would be disqualifying in terms of his service in the FBI, let alone rising to be its director. It's just unbelievable. But Diana, I did want to ask you, there's another individual who also features prominently in this conspiracy that had at one point, fairly recently as I recall, acknowledged he had voted for the communist candidate for president. And that would be the director during the Obama years of the CIA, John Brennan. Walk us through that and how his leanings fit into this drama.
Yes, well, it's quite, when you start thinking about this, the incubator of the 1980s, we have Nellie Orr going to college, and we didn't talk about this, but studying in the Soviet Union under Soviet discipline, essentially, as all Americans did who went to study in the Soviet Union, and learning to justify Stalin's crimes. In the same period, we have Christopher Steele, a confirmed socialist, doing something to earn CND credentials, you know, in the campaign for nuclear disarmament in Britain in the 1980s. We have James Comey, being a communist and studying with a disciple of Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich, the Frankfurt School at William & Mary in the 1980s. And we have John Brennan, I guess he's a bit older than the crew, in the 1970s, in the 1976 election, literally casting his vote. He was then, I believe, a junior in college, literally casting his vote for Gus Hall at a point where we've got Brezhnev leading the communist assault on the United States and the rest of the free world. And John Brennan decides this is his protest vote. Well, my question becomes, what is he protesting against?
And what is he for, no less? And at the time, of course, just to close this loop, Gus Hall was not only a perennial candidate for president, but he was the leader of the Communist Party of the United States. So it's quite a protest, one might say. But more to the point, is there other evidence in John Brennan's subsequent history that suggests his own sympathies in this regard?
Yes, I think that there are, and these are also teased out in the red thread to some great length, actually. One of the places where I learned quite a lot about James Comey was in his senior thesis at William & Mary, which was a discussion of Reinhold Niebuhr versus Jerry Falwell. And note how these names continue. We have Jerry Falwell Jr. currently being smeared by the hard left Ilhan Omar today. So, you know, these arguments, these are multi-generational. These families continue to symbolize and advance these various causes. So it's just, you know, none of this stuff stops, basically. Nothing started in 2016, which is what the left is trying to tell us about Russian influence.
And by the way, and telling us that it was manifested in completely the opposite direction from what you're recounting here. You know, nothing to see here, folks. Look over there.
Exactly. No, it's absolute madness. But, you know, so many people have so little background in this that they become manipulatable due to the information war they're being conducted very effectively.
Well, let me just say on that point, Diana West, this is what makes the research and the extraordinarily clear and thorough way in which you pull it together and make it accessible to the rest of us, notably in American Betrayal, the secret assault on our nation's character, and now in your new book, The Red Thread. Indispensable doesn't begin to describe it. This is really essential reading for anybody who is concerned about our polity and our freedoms, for that matter, to get the kind of, well, historical background and corporate memory that you're making available to us. So it's a tremendous public service because so few of us do have this background.
Well, thank you. Yes, well, it's not available to us. And I would say that all the years that, you know, researching American Betrayal and then continuing to research American Betrayal even after the publication, the research continues, actually, you know, helped me in terms of trying to turn that sort of those tools to this end. So it's a continuing process. The Brennan piece is quite interesting also. And again, going back to where it comes from, his master's thesis is available online, and indeed, I believe it was the Daily Caller. Yes, it was Charles Johnson at the Daily Caller who found it and uploaded it for anyone to look at. And this same orientation continues. So he's not just a college student voting for Gus Hall. In his thesis, which was on the subject of human rights in Egypt, a lot of these same sorts of sympathies and sort of worldviews come through as he is about to enter the CIA. So again, we're looking at this leftward ho direction of so many of the recruits of the CIA. If Nellie Orr has a CIA affiliation across the pond, Christopher Steele with his left-wing affiliations going into their intelligence service. Here we have John Brennan entering our premier intelligence service and, of course, rising to the top and rising very quickly. You see the same kind of attitude. And what really came through to me in this long and fairly turgid paper, I would say, I will say that James Comey writes more clearly than John Brennan, for what it's worth, that you get a sense of sympathy for Nasser's policy of land expropriation. I'm not even kidding. This is what comes through. You also see great hostility toward opulence and wealth, which we can take forward to the animosity toward certainly the Trump organization and the career of marketing luxury that Donald Trump and his family have been about. I mean, you see so many of these emanations, but you also see, and this is what you see in Comey and what you see in the conspiracy itself, you see utter disregard for due process and the liberties enshrined in and law enshrined in the Constitution.
Dinah West, we have to pause for one final break. This is such important work and so shocking, really, when you think about, first of all, that this has happened in our country, including in our, you know, law enforcement and intelligence services, but also that it has not come much to public light until now. Thank you for the red thread, which hopefully will cast that light very sharply. We'll be talking more with the author in a moment, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final installment of this opportunity to discuss with Dinah West her new and really important book, The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. And Dinah, there's so much to ask you about the book and about what you found in it. And I think we're going to need to get you back for another hour to drill down on some of the other pieces of this that we'll, if we're lucky, maybe just touch on. But I did want to give you a chance because Adam Schiff, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, who has been relentlessly promoting this idea that there is evidence of a collusion by Donald Trump with the Russians that resulted in his election and on and on. In the absence of any other proof of that theory, he announced that part of his contribution to the witch hunt that is now being mounted by House Democrats against Donald Trump is going to involve a further investigation into the so-called Trump Tower meeting in June of 2016. And you've drilled down on that in some detail, and I did want to give you a chance to share with our audience what you found.
Yes. Well, I hope that chairmanship drills down on the Trump Tower meeting and really gets to the bottom of who those Russians were. Because, well, actually, I can offer him up my research, which comes straight out of the interviews with the attendees of that 20-minute meeting that's gone down in history. And I will just tell him that he really is barking up the wrong tree unless he wants to demonstrate the case for democratic Russian collusion. Because what we had four so-called Russians at that meeting. And I say so-called because three of them actually hold U.S. passports as well. So already we're a little bit fuzzy on our Russians here. You can also find that three of the four, because one is actually Russian, probably were Hillary Clinton voters. And this is something they admit. One of them actually says his whole family voted for Hillary Clinton. Another, Rina Akhmetshin, his business partner of decades long, a lawyer named Edward Lieberman, very close to Madeleine Albright and Hillary Clinton, through his wife, the late Evelyn Lieberman, who was, until her death in 2015, the chief operating officer of the Hillary Clinton campaign.
Oh, I would say that's a connection.
So that's we've got two. We've got a third one, a translator named Soma Chornov, who, judging by his social media, which has been examined, was very left wing. Clearly not a Trump supporter. And then the fourth, the lawyer, the Russian lawyer of some notoriety, Natalia Veselnitskaya, certainly was no Trump supporter, and we can actually go to her social media and see her featuring that terribly vicious little meme, a painting of Putin operating Trump as his puppet, which you might have seen. It became popular in the summer of 2016. She posted that right after Donald Trump was inaugurated, and there's other evidence of her obvious loyalties to Russia, not America, and certainly not a Trump supporter, but no one in the room was. And this becomes a very salient point.
It sounds, from an intelligence tradecraft point of view, is a dangle, doesn't it? This is a trap, in other words.
It's a dirty, yes, yes. It was a place to get dirty for Don Jr. and whoever else, Jared and Kushner and Paul Manafort, who were briefly in the room. Yes, absolutely. And so if Adam Schiff wants to go there, he really, let's hope that we can bring all of this to public attention, because the whole thing disintegrates.
I'd certainly hope, Dinah West, that you've offered it, and I hope that if Adam Schiff seems unlikely to take you up on your offer, that at least the Republicans under Devin Nunes on the Intelligence Committee will, avail themselves of the research that you've done. This is really important. And lest anybody think we're grabbing at straws here, these are relevant facts about the backgrounds, about the personal leanings or actual relationships with Russian influence operations or teachings, doctrine, history that ought to inform, at a minimum, the analysis of this so-called Trump collusion conspiracy and the perpetrators of what seems to be, as you've said, Dinah West, was an anti-Trump conspiracy. You mentioned Madeleine Albright. There's another character that you feature prominently in The Red Thread, and we won't have time to do justice to his story today. I did want to ask you about a fellow by the name of Strobe Talbott. Remind of his background and help us understand what role he seems to have had in all of this.
Strobe Talbott is one of these multi-generational figures that goes back to the heart of the Clinton days, even before they started in Washington, when he was Derek Shearer's roommate at Yale and later Bill Clinton's roommate at Oxford. Very close, married to Derek Shearer's late sister, Brooke, who was a senior person inside the Clinton White House, close associate of Hillary Clinton. Again, we're starting to see this tangle of people. And Strobe was later exposed by Sergei Tretyakov, who's a very important defector, a senior Soviet/Russian spy master, who was the subject of a book known as Comrade J by former Washington Post reporter Pete Early, as having been an asset of Russian intelligence, known as a special unofficial contact. And this gets back to what we were talking about at the very beginning with Whitaker Chambers' discussion of the importance of influence to the Kremlin, to the whole communist conspiracy in terms of using people, manipulating people at the levers of power. And according to the way the Russians looked at it, Strobe Talbot was such a person. Now we can bring this right into the Steele dossier.
But before you go there, I just one other piece of his biography. Strobe Talbot was the Deputy Secretary of State during the Clinton administration. So he's gone on to be the president of Brookings for life, I guess, but he's the guy who was very much in a position to help with Soviet or Russian at the time influence operations in that capacity, among others.
Even more to the point, yes, he was the leader. He's the lead architect of what was known as the Troika, the American Troika, looking at the transition from the Soviet Union to Russia. During the Clinton years, that was Strobe Talbot, Vice President Gore, who's got his own red thread, going back to his father and Armin Hammer and so on, and Larry Summers. And it was Strobe Talbot who was really the senior idea person on that team. So this was a key position for the Russians to regard as a special unofficial contact. Another example of a special unofficial contact, to give you some context, is Raul Castro.
Puts him in a pretty distinctive class, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Very special, however unofficial. And in terms of our current day, it's not just a sort of a historical footnote here. We're looking at someone who is also involved with Christopher Steele in conversation, as we've learned from a British deposition, during the 2016 campaign season. So this is a thread that just keeps on unspooling, and very important to bring out some of the other aspects of his involvement and his family's involvement. And I'm really looking forward to doing that in greater detail with you.
Well, we will definitely have you back for this purpose, among others. Dinah West, there is so much in this new book of yours that really cries out for close scrutiny, not just by, the public, but by those who are charged with protecting us from enemies, foreign and domestic. In fact, as you know, every one of us who served in the government and Congress or in the executive branch takes an oath to do that. And it is high time, in certain quarters particularly, that this kind of care about what Whitaker Chambers rightly warned of as the more serious threat, namely those enemies within the influence operations, not just the espionage business, be taken very much to heart. Dinah, congratulations on The Red Thread, A Search for Ideological Drivers Inside the Anti-Trump Conspiracy. It is extraordinarily important, and we're very proud to have been associated with you in getting it out, and we'll look forward to further conversations with you on it and much, much more. We'll talk with the rest of you, I hope, again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.